Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
We're on a narrow sort of knife ridge that goes up to the summit.
And I saw a healer who took out like 95 discarnate spirits out of my body in an hour and a half, and it just about blew my brains out when it happened.
It smells cellular somehow.
And they had built this enormous bonfire. It was blazing to the heavens.
This journey that we do is a learning.
Say that without burping.
I kind of did a hiccup there tonight. Tonight.
Hiccuping in from the far west. Welcome to Hitchhiking Off the Map. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
And we're coming to you from our home studio in Sebastopol, California, with trees in bloom and new windscreens on our microphones. We're getting very upscale here. The windscreens are to prevent pea pops.
I made them, and instead of $35 a piece, it cost $1.49.
Something to think about as a gift for your friends and family.
If they blow in your ear.
Okay. So today we're going to visit with a friend whose trips have taken her to Africa and to jail and other stops on the itinerary.
And there's a story about selling a house.
It's not a how-to story, however.
No.
Okay, this program can be a lot of things. It will always be about journeys, but the one thing we will avoid is saying anything practical.
Except the essential knowledge of where to get a cappuccino in Elko, Nevada.
Well, we did that last, but I think we were wrong. I think Cowboy Joe's is not in Elko. I think it begins with a W. I can't remember. Somebody please call in. I want those people to stay in business. Several years ago, we did a series called Weavers, and one of our favorite visits was with Judy Claude, who'd been very active in the civil rights movement and now heads a very active small community foundation in Philadelphia.
And we pulled out that interview recently and thought, we've got to play that again. Here is Judy Claude.
Who are the people the media call activists? Did you ever wonder about it? What makes activists so active? What do they do for a good time? In Philadelphia, there's a foundation called Bread and Roses Community Fund. We went there to check out activists.
Bread and Roses has made a commitment to fund those organizations that are working for social change. And by that, we mean that we fund groups who many times are involved in demonstrations and educational activities, advocacy work, etc., to try to change social policy. It really seeks out what we consider to be groups that are usually too radical or too small or too controversial to be funded by traditional foundations. Because most foundations look for a flavor of the day. And, you know, after a certain point, civil liberties and demonstrations were no longer the flavor of the day. So that's really the difference, I think, for Bread and Roses.
What's constantly amazed me in doing interviews is the roundabout road that brought people to wherever they are now. So I asked,
how did I get involved with this? I grew up in West Philly. Made a decision to go south because that's where the action was in 63 when I graduated, and swore to my mother that in my first year of college I would not be involved, would not go to jail, basically. I had to swear on a Bible, and in my second semester I was in jail. So much for that swearing, okay? And eventually dropped out of Fisk in Nashville and spent some time with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and then came back to Philadelphia in 67. Finished at Temple in economics, and then did a lot of work around what was then the Black Power Movement, Pan-African Movement. Lived in Tanzania for 2 years. And then started working mainly in religious organizations at that point who were still fairly radical to do community organizing work and that kind of stuff. I grew up in a fairly nuclear family, okay? One sister, just she and I. She's older. Mom and dad, my parents divorced in 58, which was very uncommon at that point. But I had a really strong extended family on both sides. So it's like my grandfather, my father's father, came up the summer after my parents divorced and said to my mother, remember, if talking about my father, if Chris at some point does not do child support or whatever he's supposed to do, you just let me know. We'll take care of that. Right? I think my father lived under this threat all his life. Okay. And so I think for my sister and I, there was always, there was security and there was never a sense of insecurity at all. But my parents also were fairly conscious. So I always tell people this, the earliest thing I remember about television is my mother watching the McCarthy hearings. And I always remember how she said, they got him, they got him. But none of that meant anything to me, kind of, because, you know, I was like 6, 7, 8, 9. I mean, but it's just there. It's just part of the, you know, river of memory. And I've heard Julian Bond talk about this too, but the thing that always stayed in my mind was Jet Magazine in 1955 published a picture of Emmett Till in his casket. I can nearly draw that picture. That is the picture that almost everyone I knew who was in SNCC had that image in their mind and still does. And we can still see Emmett Till in his coffin in Jet Magazine. It is with this swollen face. It is an unbelievable thing.
So you're off to college. You've promised your mom you'll study hard and stay out of trouble. But it's, what, 1963?
Was I scared? We had been picketing this restaurant in Nashville, Tennessee. We had been picketing this restaurant most of the late March, early April of, I guess it was 64. And finally, they moved on us. And the first time the cops moved, the line dispersed. And we literally broke ranks. And we went around the corner. And we had this long discussion because we had not come prepared to go to jail. And then we made a decision. And then we were scared because a lot of us in that particular demonstration were freshmen at Fisk. I mean, our parents were ready to shoot us when they found out. And so we went back and knew that when we went back, we were going to get arrested. And we were arrested, and next thing I know, we are all going to jail, and then our lawyer is going to jail, and then his friend, the other attorney, is going to jail, and then a couple other ministers are going to jail, and I look up, and everybody's going to jail. And I'm like thinking, oh, God, my mother is going to kill me. I mean, that literally was my first reaction. She is going to kill me. They housed us all in one cell, and there had to be about 40 to 50 women in one cell, and then decided to intimidate us by housing in the cell with us women who were in there for murder. Except politics create different phenomena. And so the women were fascinated with the fact that we young people were willing to stay in jail. And we stayed for 2 weeks, and I came back to the dorm, and my mother must have had radar, because within 15 minutes after I was in the dorm, the phone rang, and it was my mother. And my mother didn't say hello. She said, "Were you raped?" That was her first question. I said, "No, Mom, but I got lice in my hair." And I said, rape? No. I mean, but that was because she had heard about what had happened to some of the women who had gone to jail in Mississippi and so forth. So that was her first concern. And later when I talked to my father says, "Please don't do this again. This really is not good for me." He says, "Your mother about drove me crazy." Okay. I don't know. I took a bite of the apple, and I've just been nibbling at that fruit ever since. I mean, it's just been a real part of me ever since. And it is interesting to watch what has happened to all of us who came through the civil rights movement, because I think so many of us were able to find places where we could continue to do, quote, good. And yet, we lost a lot of folk. I mean, we lost them either mentally and emotionally, or we lost them physically, okay, because we failed to understand that it's all right to take a vacation or it's all right to have some time to do some reflection. And it took me a long time. I used to think vacations was a bourgeoisie trip. I mean, you know, that you shouldn't do that. I can't wait to go on vacation, 2 weeks minimum, okay? I mean, it's taken me a long time to realize how important that is. And also living overseas enabled me to take a break as well. That was the other thing, to look at the U.S. from a different perspective.
In the 70s, she went to Africa. I never asked her what brought that about. I had the sense it came out of a great need.
Tanzania had a President Nyerere who had offered sanctuary to Afro-Americans who didn't want to go into the war. There was a large Afro-American community in Tanzania. It was also the Dar es Salaam, the capital, was also the site of the OAAU, the OAU's Liberation Committee. So that meant that all the representatives of the liberation forces in Africa were based in Dar es Salaam. And so that whole exchange between Afro-Americans from the United States and the liberation forces from, you know, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, you know, Namibia, etc., that was a very rich and a struggle too, because we didn't always agree about certain kinds of things. And it was a chance to do some reflection about this country, okay, and about the struggles that I had been involved in up until 74. And so for me personally, it was a healing time. I remember crying for like, I don't know how many days. And the tears were just years of having believed in, you know, rapid social change and then realizing that change doesn't happen like that. And, you know, by 74, you began to realize that things were going to take a lot longer to change than you thought. And so it was a serious healing process. And I think that was true for a number of Afro-Americans who were living there. There was also a rich intellectual exchange. It was the first time that I really had a chance to really interact and talk with Cubans, because Tanzania had a diplomatic relationship with Cuba. And so it was, you know, unlike here, it was a chance to have that kind of interaction. And at that point, the Chinese were building the railroad from Dar es Salaam to Zambia. I mean, the Chinese grew their own food. They moved, they built encampments as they moved along. They trained people as they went. This is completely different than what, you know, the U.S. or anyone else does when they come into a third world country. And yet they were wrong about certain things politically. The Chinese were wrong. I mean, I was not a Maoist, so I was like, they're wrong. We also could see the weaknesses. So the idealism about Africa was stripped from our eyes. But also there was a real appreciation of the reality of Africa, too. And I remember the Tanzanian family that I was very close to asked me why I was coming back. And I said, well, let me put it to you this way. I miss my tribe. I miss my nuances. I miss the way we talk, the way we walk. I'm going home. Okay, I mean, I never thought I would say that, but I'm going home. This is home. I mean, I'm an American, whether I like it or not. This is who I am. And when I came back from Africa, I was really clear. This was it. This was home. I mean, we make it here or we don't make it at all.
What I was hearing from her, I think, is that the work of social change didn't just happen outside herself.
But there is something else that has raised my consciousness as well, and that has been to balance with breast cancer. The concept, the idea of having cancer can be a defining experience in terms of enabling a person, and then particularly enabling me, to gain a finer appreciation of every single day. So every day becomes important and precious and a gift. And so you don't care about lying about your age anymore because you're just so happy you got there. In 1984, when I was diagnosed, I was just 37 years old. I mean, it was a frightening thing. And I remember my husband asking me, are you worried about being, you know, scarred or something? Because we were trying to make a decision about whether I get a mastectomy or a lumpectomy. I said, no, I'm worried about dying. I never even thought about the scarring part at all. Dying is what I was worried about. I mean, it was coming to grips with knowing that you finally don't have control. Okay, I think cancer makes you realize that you're all vulnerable. And particularly if you're control crazy like me, you realize that you're vulnerable no matter what you do. This one is not in your control. And so it really became important for me to begin to let go in terms of control, and also to begin to learn to appreciate every day and realize that it was a gift. I talked about it. That was the other thing that was different too. because in my talking about it, I discovered so many other women who had had breast cancer, but who never talked about it. And I kept saying, well, what good are you if you don't talk about it? Got to talk about it. Got to talk about it. It's really important that you talk about it. And I also think that it's also been important for me to know that my friends have not treated me any differently because I've had breast cancer. So there's very little sympathy. You know what I mean? It's like they still demand the same things from me. I mean, it's, you know, I can't use excuses or anything like that.
So we came up to the present. Not the best time to be a radical.
Well, you know, I always tell people that you've got to understand history in terms of struggle, that you've got to have a historical perspective on struggle. I can say that at 50 now. So this is a nadir. And what I, for those who are feeling very depressed, I keep saying, but we've been here before as a nation. And that period of time after World War II was the most unique period in U.S. history. I mean, we have not had that kind of economic dominance before. If we've not, you know, this is more like what's the real the U.S. And what, quite frankly, our groups do keeps me going, too. I mean, that I just figure that there are groups like the ones in the Delaware Valley all across the country who are doing things. I got criticisms of them in terms of being maybe too narrow and not thinking more globally, etc. But nonetheless, they're working. And I believe that out of the seeds of their work comes a new movement, and it'll probably be about 2010. Okay, you can quote me on that.
In Philadelphia, we were talking with Judy Claude.
This is Hitchhiking Off the Map. Where you live, where you belong. The stories about journeys are all about going someplace, and maybe they're about that place you're going to, but it's also about leaving. What are you leaving?
Or what will you come back to?
We've moved our residence about 20 times, I think, over the course of time, and I've always had a very conflicted feeling about the places we've left, because there you're not coming back. You might go past sometime, but you are gone. I mean, even if it's the basement apartment in Chicago that we really wanted to leave.
That was a real Lulu. It was below ground level so that all the cars parking at the sidewalk could blow right straight in the bedroom window from their tailpipes. And the ceiling was so low that the steam pipes were at far-red level, so you had to duck to either avoid bonking or burning.
But the a really cute little house in Milwaukee, and we fixed it up, painted it, nice, strong, warm colors, really made it look so nice looking that the landlord's daughter looked around at all the houses Daddy owned and decided that's where she wanted to live.
Sometimes there's other things going on. I mean, I drove past the place in Indiana, the farm where I grew up, and I drove up and down the road 3 times before I finally stopped because, first of all, the area had changed so much I wasn't even sure it was the right place. But then when I was sure it was, it took me that long just to get up the guts to stop and go up to the door and knock and say to the people, sorry to interrupt, but I grew up here, and I wonder if I might walk around outside for a while.
We would like to hear your stories about moving, the place you left, what that was like, what it meant to leave it. Visit our website, www.independentei.org, I is E-Y-E, and drop us an email.
Now, this story coming up is sort of based on our own experience about 10 years ago when we tried to sell our house in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, when we were moving to Philadelphia.
And I hope that we don't quite embody the attitudes and mindsets that the characters do here.
And I hope that they don't wind up losing as much money as we did.
But attitudes and mindsets are pretty complex in real life. And these people, I guess, are really kind of floundering to find a moral center, as do we all.
This story is called What's Buried.
You down there?
In the kitchen.
I couldn't find you.
I was just checking what we left in the kitchen. Well, so you saw everything?
Great house.
It is just beautiful.
Nice bedroom.
Did you see everything?
Oh, we did.
The grand tour.
It's been a good old house for us. One thing I really love is the space. We walked in here the first time, looked clear on in through to the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Wow, and the dining room mirrors.
No, I like the mirrors.
Now that's what our kids are going to miss. You know, 11 and 6, and they still make faces in the mirror.
Well, I see, I just worry about, well, we'll be eating dinner, and Dwight won't ever look at me none, because he'll be seeing himself in the mirror.
Oh, I'll look at you, woman. Don't you think I won't?
And this is all the original woodwork. Now, they did a little piecing on the floor here, but otherwise...
Why are you moving?
Yeah, well, that's a bunch of things.
Richard's going into middle school, and Sarah's just starting.
Yeah, and I grew up in the country. I like a little more green around.
Although there is a backyard here.
You've been on the market for a while.
Yeah, well, that's why we're showing it ourselves. You know, the realtor we had didn't really do much, so we figured...
Well, no, we really enjoyed it here, but...
Yeah, when I first brought it up, Trish just looked at me and said...
Move?
Well, I'm just bringing it up.
I love it here. Well, what about Richard, Sarah?
Don't jump all over me.
Why?
I talked to two realtors. We're going to have a very difficult time getting our money out of this place. Property is taking a nosedive.
Why?
Take a look.
At what?
At the neighborhood. People moving in.
So?
It's not safe.
Safe? I feel safe.
I don't mean it's not safe, but it's the perception. There's three houses on the block that are still single family. Everything else is apartments. That's a different class of people.
A different class
I don't mean a worse class. I mean a different class.
Ollie...
Ollie, did you turn off the lights upstairs?
Yep.
I should look at the kitchen again.
Sure.
Is there a way to get gas hooked up here? I don't like to cook on electric.
Yeah, right back there.
Yeah, so are you folks from around here?
Oh, yeah. We've been at Fifth and Lemon for 19 years.
Oh, yeah.
But our daughter's moving back with us with our grandson, and that's one of those things look like it's going to be for a while.
Huh.
And then that area's not safe now.
Yeah, so. Well, that's one thing around here. It's safe.
And our little boy, Michael, he'll be starting a school, so we're kind of worried about that.
Yeah, well, you saw the school. It's just two blocks. Sarah would have been going there. It's a nice mix of kids.
60% minority. I mean, that's not a problem. It's an advantage in some ways.
Ollie. Yeah.
But you know what happens, place like that. They cut the budget, the good teachers get out, you get 10-year-old kids with knives. It's a fact.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's a fact.
It's so close. But then I think of her walking by that intersection with those people that hang out there.
It'd be nice to have a yard, a big yard they can play in.
Yeah.
I really love the backyard. We just got an alley running by the back.
It's little... But it's nice for flowers.
My grandma had geraniums. Michael's grandma's gonna have geraniums.
Yeah, you don't have to mortar anything.
Yeah, that's good by me.
Richard and his friends, they were always out there. They made a little cubby hole under the porch. And the pets...
Yeah, a couple pets had funerals there.
Star. Remember Star? Oh, Star.
Richard. Honey, you awake? Honey, Star died last night. We thought she would.
She's quiet now.
Poor Star.
But we'll bury her in the backyard, okay? And we can make a gravestone and she'll always be there.
She'll stay there.
We'll always have our Star.
Star. Cat.
Cat? We got three cats.
Well, three cats have got us.
Well, anyway, so...
Think about it. Give us a call.
Oh, we will. Yeah. And, the woodwork.
It's a great house.
Yeah, it is. I hate to leave it. I really hate it.
I hate it. Specifically, I hate them.
What?
People coming in here looking at the house. It's our damned house. Oh, they're nice people. They're fine. I hope they buy it. But I just thought of being replaced, bumped out. This is our roots. We've got things buried here. We made two babies, and we had 10 dozen quarrels, and we made up 10 dozen times, and your mother fell down the stairs, and the cat peed on the carpet, and... I love this place.
I love it.
I love it. So why are we moving?
We're moving because we are being moved. The neighborhood, okay, but the neighborhood was the Collinses who moved away. And old lady, Mrs. Dickerson on the corner, she's gone. The tree in the alley, they took that out.
I'm very confused right now.
It's nothing personal, Ollie. It's my choice, too. It's a matter of dollars and cents and the kids.
I'm very confused.
What's the matter?
Nothing. I was kind of confused. I was trying to remember. I already forgot the phone number.
It's funny to see it empty.
I know that feeling.
It sure is.
Yeah, well, so, any questions or...
No. We'll talk it over and give you a call right away.
Yeah, I think you'd get some good value here.
I love it. I really do.
There's a lot buried there.
Goodbye, Star. All right, you get the lines?
Sure.
Yeah, so, you have this just to the one daughter?
No, we've got three. Two girls and a boy. 2 grandkids, 3 cats.
Cats.
Goodbye, Star.
That was What's Buried. Joining us were Ricardo Martin and Jacqueline Yancey, and the engineer was John Ewell. Hitchhiking Off the Map is a production of The Independent Eye. You can visit our website at www.independenteye.org. You really enjoy the website, I think. You browse around through our ancient history and be amazed.
And also, to contribute stories to the show or purchase CDs, visit the site or call us at 1-800-357-6016.
And please, let us know how you like the show. We're just starting out at the beginning of a long trip, and we'd like to know what works for you, what you'd like to hear. We are very much in process of evolution.
Hitchhiking is supported by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Hitchhikers Guild,
which you can join. No experience required, just a thumb and a small check. And we were looking for quotes about home, but everything was so sloppy sentimental. And then we found Huckleberry Finn, who said, "There weren't no home like a raft, after all. Other places do seem so cramped up and smothery, but a raft don't. You feel mighty free and easy and comfortable on a raft."
We go, we check into a hotel, because you can't get a hotel anything closer. We check into a hotel. They pull aside one of my friends who was white to let her know they would prefer that I not swim in the pool. This is New Jersey, 1964. I am flabbergasted. Of course we went into the pool. Everybody went into the pool. I mean.